Dobar dan na valovih Radija Študent ali pa dobar dan na internetu Cirkulacije 2. We have here a special guest, John Duncan.
Good afternoon.
So John Duncan is American artist but living abroad almost half a life.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. More than half a life.
More than half a life. But yeah. You still remember where you were born.
All too well, yeah.
Yeah. But you try to get away from it, to forget.
Since
it?
I left, yeah.
Because you said that you are still in good relations with the parents. You still communicate with them.
Well, my father died.
Uh-huh.
So we have conversations, but and they're more friendly now.
Okay, so here are somehow the situation is that we've invited you to work on some kind of horizontal level, but yeah. You as elderly person, so to somehow share the information or experiences, especially experiences that we have on the level of sound art, especially sound art, but also on the level of this, what we call intermediate art. Here is also Stefan Döpner, who is part of Cirkulacija, and Boštjan Leskovšek, also part of Cirkulacija, and Iva Tratnik, the newest part of Cirkulacija.
Comet at Cirkulacija.
Who?
A comet. Comet. Sometimes she appears and then she disappears and comes back.
But maybe the beginnings, no? Let's say the beginnings of you, right? Because this is presentation of you. I find your topics of interest, which are, for instance, I don't know, a bit outside of the sound, for which you are best known, in a body.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And tell us something about
the. Well, the thing that sort of led me into the body was the idea that certain topics, certain things were not discussed, were not talked about, were not acknowledged. You didn't think about them, you didn't deal with them. And I learned that from the example in my family that by trying to ignore these things, by trying to ignore the body, by trying to ignore basically anything, that it enslaves you. So the idea was of exploring these things was to try to find out what they are in order to avoid being manipulated by them.
And you think this manipulation came from the society, the state also?
Well, it came from my family. I don't know. It came from the religion that they followed. It came from not asking questions. It came from refusing to examine something, to simply accept it instead of looking at it and trying to really understand it.
And you use Wilhelm Reich a lot?
Yeah. Some time ago, yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, I think before I was elderly.
It's about the problems of sexual repression.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you, give some hints about eyes.
You can give?
No, you.
I think John can do it better. But if we are not interested in this, then we can skip it. No? You were becoming active in the 70s.
Yeah.
You studied in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
With Professor
Alan Kaprow. Alan Kaprow was the guy who invented the happening.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the school that I attended we were given, the students were all given mentors. And he was assigned as my mentor. So he would come and look every once in a while at the work that I'd made, and we'd talk about ideas. And more than that, we sort of became friends. And we kept contact after, long after I left school. So we would talk about a number of different things. He, for one thing, he told me, don't ever, ever, ever have any children. Big mistake. Don't ever do it. So that was one.
Did he say why?
No, he didn't say why.
Like you cannot be a successful artist when you have children or something like
no,
that.
No, he just said what was unsaid was that, I mean, he never said it in so many words, but the implication was that your freedom to do what you want, to live the way you want, is gone when you have kids.
And he had kids?
He had three.
So talking from experience.
Yes, right? Exactly, yes. Yeah.
I could imagine that what he thought was that one changes his personality, somehow becomes elderly.
Well, it appears that happens anyway. I don't know.
Yeah, but you say that you are young, that we are all young still.
I don't have any illusions about how old or young I am, but I am more curious now than I've ever been. I have more energy to explore that curiosity than I did.
And courage, probably.
I am not. I'm afraid of one thing: ignorance. Yeah, that really scares me, because it's really difficult to get out of that. It's a real trap. But anything else? No.
Do you have kids?
Hell no.
I know. You followed the
advice. No.
So this was Alan Kaprow. When I translated, I also found that you already were dealing with this in practice as artist, with these happenings, also in homes.
I'm trying to think. Not that I can remember.
Yeah, so then.
There was one performance that I did called Scare, where the where I went to houses of people I knew, two people that I knew, and knocked on the door. As soon as they opened the door, I shot them in the face with a blank gun and then took off. I was wearing a mask, so they couldn't see who it was. So they opened the door to a stranger who shoots them in the face and takes off. Then the idea of that came from a mugging. I was attacked on the street. And when there were three kids who came up to us. Two of them were talking to us, giving the idea that they had a gun. And there were three of them. But the third person circled around behind us and hit me over the back of the head with a stick that broke when it hit. So I heard this really loud crack in my right at my ear, and if you're hit at a certain point in the neck, you just fall. Yeah, it's a classic judo and karate move to hit somebody just in a certain place in the neck, and they just, if you're hit like that, you lose control of your body for a second. You just fall like a sack. So I got hit and I fell, and I thought while I fell that I'd been shot in the neck. So I pulled my hand away from the place where I was hit, yeah. And my hand was dry. There was nothing. There was no, you know, there was no blood. There was nothing there at all. So I knew I was okay. And I went from cold terror to hot anger in a split second. And that moment of going from one extreme to another like that, I thought was an art experience, and I wanted to give that experience to other people.
To a friend.
So I chose people who I knew well, who I thought, I considered this very carefully for a couple of weeks, actually, trying to figure who would be able to appreciate this in the way that I intended, and not turn it into a source for paranoia or revenge or something outside of that, this moment.
Yeah.
Who could just deal with this moment? It's there were two people, and I did this to both of them, and then called them a day or two afterwards to tell them that I was the person who had done this, and to find out if they had accepted it in the way that I had intended. And they did.
Really?
Both of them?
Yeah, they both did.
I hardly believe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And were you speaking about this possible experience, like then, which you had and which you wanted to transport?
Well, talking to them about the experience was unnecessary because that was their experience.
That was their experience, and that was
having this gun go off in your face was their experience.
So it was an acoustic shot, but not a shot, or no, just
it was a gun loaded with blanks.
Yeah,
yeah. It was a 9mm Smith and Wesson pistol loaded with blanks.
Yeah, I read about this. I was really also wondering what these people. I know this story. Is it possible?
It's a fairly well-known story. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah.
I thought this guy is crazy. When I heard it first.
Yeah, well, they
say
the same thing. They still do. Yeah, they still do.
But they are artists.
Yeah.
The guys.
Yeah, they're both artists.
And you think that they achieved some higher level of accepting the moment or the life?
That I don't know, but we are still friends. So at least
that's a lot.
Yeah, there is that.
And when you were attacked, do you think that it changed how you withstand the world? You're not scared anymore so much?
I'm not, no. No. I had a job where I was wearing a uniform. I was a bus driver, and people would come on and threaten me every 20 minutes with something, with a knife or a pistol or a chain. And after a while, you just go... Yeah, if you're going to do it, go stand in line. All these other people want to do the same thing. Yeah.
What job was this?
Driving a bus. South Central Los Angeles.
Okay.
9 p.m. to 6 a.m., so I was out there all night. Yeah. Yeah. So, no, I'm not afraid of weapons or being attacked or... yeah. If someone actually shoots me, then that's just game over. They do me a favor. Yeah.
And at that time, you already were dealing also with sound as medium, artistic material.
Yeah. I really got into making sound. Yeah, right around that same time. That's true.
Which was when?
76, 77. Yeah, 100 years ago.
With elderly, he meant just like...
I know.
Elder statesman, for example.
Yeah.
You're the elder noise man. That's...
Yeah.
The father of...
Yeah.
Like, you know, Stellag
children,
is...
which are us.
Uncle. How it's called with Stellag, he's...
Grandfather.
No, not grandfather, but...
Doctor of... The Duke of... The Count
the Godfather. The Godfather of cyber... Yeah, something okay. They call him.
Yeah, really?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What?
So then, at some point, you left for Japan.
Yeah.
Probably escaping the army or not?
No, I was very lucky in that way. I'm registered as a conscientious objector.
Which means?
It means that you don't fight.
But you were drafted, I think,
that was,
in some hospital, yeah. Like you were. Actually, you were.
Like the civil. Then you do some civil service instead.
They didn't ask me to do that.
I am.
Because the army induction changed the year after I was given this status.
It was no more drafting then.
Right.
It was professional army.
Well, yeah, it was a volunteer army.
A volunteer.
Yeah.
So, and in Japan, what I read was that you were becoming very active with the noise scene, the sound, art scene.
Yeah.
Also on the level of these toilet exhibitions.
Yeah. That was Toilet Exhibition was a series of collages that I did where it was the collages combined material from pornographic magazines and news images, especially news images from bombings, from mass killings or mass.
This was in the '80s.
Yeah, this was. There were images coming from Beirut. News images that we see. Now, I mean, now it's Aleppo. You see images coming from Syria. You see images of homes of cities that are completely destroyed. Gaza, another classic example.
And was it called, like, was there something called, like, a noise scene already in that time, or was it in the industrial scene?
It wasn't called that. It was, at that time, it was a group of people who were just making as much chaotic noise as they could make.
So it was really different from this industrial scene also.
Yeah,
because his images were very much also like from Robin Gristle to Test Department to Gerechtigkeitsliga. I don't know. They all were dealing just with these images.
Yeah, but that
rather with historical more actually, not so up to date. I think as you use them, but
the industrial scene, as I understand it, was more focused on the mechanization of human life and turning human life into this mechanical process, and humans as in one sense participants, but in another sense components of this
machinery.
Largely mechanical process. Mm-hmm. In Japan, it was something entirely different. Mm-hmm. In Japan, there is chaos all around you, all the time. There is no privacy. There is just bombardment, constant bombardment, visually, in terms of sound, in terms of lights flashing, in terms of moving images, constantly what's the word I'm looking for? Imposing themselves on your field of vision. So the noise scene in Japan was a response to that. It was a reaction, mm-hmm. to that more than being part of some large machine. And I found that much more sort of immediate and interesting. I mean, more relevant to what I was seeing every day.
So it's industrial European.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is, huh? Because America is more chaotic also, was in a way still, it's...
For example.
It's more anarchic, mm-hmm. no? This is what I was talking today. People want to take care of themselves and not the state.
Yeah, I would say it's more anarchic. Yeah, true.
The bands, for instance, or the individuals, the two.
I was thinking because for me, I was really...
Zev is, for instance.
Yeah, Zev, but no, for my was like...
Zev is
so
more
anarchic. It was a test department, for me, for example, very much. It was SBK, it was in Germany was smaller bands also, some industrial scene just which was all around, and it was completely very nice how you described it, and for me it was really this part, this completely mechanization of society, mm-hmm. and yeah. And this is very European actually, and I can imagine, I mean, if you look to Asia, that is not much faster game, so to say, going on.
I wouldn't leave U.S. out.
No, it's not really.
For Europe, it's U.S. first, and then comes Europe.
Industrial.
I disagree with that. When I lived in L.A., we were really influenced by Throbbing Gristle and what was going on in Europe. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Who would be the earliest industrial bands in
Robert Rentel, Warm Leatherette.
Yeah.
That was an eye-opening moment. This the idea of the sound of a machine becoming an aesthetic object rather than an annoyance. That it changed everything.
It's also what changed for me a lot.
yeah. And of course, the Throbbing Gristle track "Hamburger Lady" that was a sea change in terms of what we understood as music.
What about Residents? We have one,
but it's not industrial.
The Residents is not.
Yeah, it's not kind of music. Maybe not, no, but
the Residents were not. They weren't an industrial band. They were
an artistic band.
Yeah, they were more like a. There were a number of very odd. Projects like that. There was a group called the Tubes that was all about making kind of sarcastic comments about about society at the time, and about what passes for daily life. The residents did this as well. They made certain kind of gestures or criticisms, really, of what was passing for normal life. The closest to industrial and noise, like sort of combining these two things, was SRL, Survival Research Labs.
But they did not really...
They didn't try to make music.
Or something, but it was all noise, yes. And
But they made an incredible amount of... The machines that they built incredible amount of noise, and it was all about these mechanisms that were...
But because of that, they became so much part of industrial aesthetics also.
Exactly, yeah.
Completely. For us, they were like... So Gerechtigkeitsjäger were the first in Bremen showing SRL videos in 82 or something. Or 80
okay.
Something, 84.
Okay.
So this was... And so it was embedded in the industrial.
Yeah.
So for us. Yeah. The noise in that time, I had no idea of.
There was no word for noise. Eh?
No, also, but I had also known this was even, I think, John Peel. Mm. I mean, you were, it was possible, it was really bandwidth, very broad bandwidth which he presented, from ska to, I don't know, industrial and jazz and I don't know, but...
Yeah, but he never touched this, did he?
He never touched it.
Yeah.
Right. There is no recordings, I think, of anything which we would call now noise.
Yes. Well, let me give an example of concert, noise concert, a group called Hijokaidan. Everybody was calling themselves kings of noise. It was. I mean, Merzbau did it, and Masona did it. Hijokaidan did it all the time. The Incapacitants did it, but. There were a lot of different people doing a kind of chaotic moments. Hijokaidan, for example, would perform, and Junko, the vocalist, would perform in a wedding dress. Mikawa Toshiji, who worked in a bank, would come on stage in his suit. Jojo Hiroshige would play guitar. Mikawa was playing electronics that he'd built, and he would overdrive the whatever machine he had with him until it burned up. Junko would lift up her wedding dress and piss on the stage, and then Mikawa would run around on the stage in his suit and slip and fall in the piss, and then go wear this suit the next day to the bank where he worked. And you know, I mean, he was a commodities broker, so his customers had to take him seriously. He represented the bank, but he's the next day he's there smelling a piss. This kind of thing was going on, and then in the background. Well, we did this together. This was one concert, or we did this together. They're doing that on the stage, and I'm in the back with a smoke machine, filling the room with smoke, so nobody could see anything. And people on the stage couldn't see each other. The whole place was just completely full of smoke. Yeah.
And then this is kind of punk then. Japanese punk?
It's a different thing. It's not. Punk was more. punk scene more like fashion.
Yeah, imported stuff also.
Influenced, definitely influenced by what was going on in London, but it was all coming from photographs. It was coming from images of London punks with their hair sprayed up like a mohawk, standing like
fresh from
several
England.
Centimeters above their head. Yeah. Different colors, this kind of thing. They saw people, punks in Japan saw this, and they did that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but these people were different. They weren't following trends. They were trying to find something that was outside of all that. Yeah. Another example is Masana, who would play for. His events lasted maybe 30 seconds, sometimes a minute, where he would pre-record noise. I don't actually know how he made it. Maybe feedback with a guitar or feedback from a microphone, multi-layered. I don't know how he did it actually, but he would. Put on this tape, and then he would jump. He would climb up onto the PA system, and then jump onto a drum set that was on the stage, and play the drums in this way. He would jump onto the drum set, and fall onto it. And he just kept doing that. He kept going back, climbing back up onto the speaker, and then jumping onto the drums.
But this was when also 80s or?
Yeah. Yeah, this was all at the same time.
It's very much like body art in the 70s or something.
Well,
I mean, but just
way,
by this
yeah.
extreme
yeah.
exposure, I mean.
Yeah.
Not that it's
yeah.
a copy of it, I just...
I'd have to ask him if he was influenced by that. But he would... For him, it was a kind of endurance. Where he would endure the pain of jumping onto this, like falling onto this drum set, onto the metal, onto the these hard surfaces, just keep jumping onto them until he just couldn't deal with it anymore. He couldn't suffer it anymore. So these performances lasted 30 seconds, sometimes a minute, sometimes 2 minutes, but no more than that.
Yes, it's indifferent. I remember Stella, how you were telling me how it started with body art, like some things at least around, like people which just like would be on the stage and or on the floor, and then there's a box and they stay, or a chair, and they go up the chair and down the chair and up the chair and down the chair until they cannot, but this lasts then hours and hours and hours until they couldn't do anymore. And it ended where he went out then with people which were actually committing publicly planned suicide.
But these Japanese, did they regard themselves as artists or?
Sure.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah.
So this was then some message told, not just for themselves, probably, because they were performing live. No? I think art has
yeah.
a public message.
It had the feeling more of investigation than trying to get a message across. It's more trying to find out something.
Of themselves.
Yeah.
And of the surrounding somehow.
Yeah.
It's always you in
yeah.
relation. No? Or what do people say when you do... I mean,
what was the response from the audience, for instance?
Applause.
It was artistic performance.
More.
yeah. Do it again. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's really interesting to hear how many kind of values and interests and investigations and images and icons were shared in this noise and industrial scene, mm-hmm. even it was so much different. I mean, industrial was much more poppy becoming, I mean, even early, always dealing with this pop level noise.
Yeah.
Not.
Yeah.
But for example, the founder of Test Department, he's also someone who has permanent pain in his leg. And even the last performance I saw with him, two decades, was completely, you know, like this, like the, mm-hmm. his pain, him bound somewhere in and being like a bell, you know, thrown, like the thing mm-hmm. in the bell thrown mm-hmm. against mm-hmm. a wall, as long as he could.
Yeah.
Manage.
Yeah.
So still, this was in 96 and even. But these, and these images were all in this completely self. You had to investigate yourself and you were doubting mm-hmm. all the relations. All this, you know, all this was like not. It was like just what is this projection here, and I have to find out where I am with these kind of actions. And it was really, I mean, when I hear this, it's really very, very close. It was, I mean, in the industrial scene where I was in, it was just for some years, and then it disappeared.
Yeah.
With some, it took, like, with Test Department, then this later NSA.
Yeah, well, a lot of these
NVA, that's it, National Vita Activities.
A lot of these people were influenced by the Aktionismus group from Vienna.
It can be, yeah.
And that's the same thing. Those guys were trying to find some way to get through conventions, all the social conventions they were surrounded with and sort of tied by, you know, bound by. They were trying to find some way to cut them and look for some sort of truth. Schwarzkopf was like this. Yeah. His the guy who was in his events, Heinz Cibulka, is still like this. Yeah. He's an amazing artist. Heinz Cibulka is really an amazing artist. Still going, still strong, stronger than ever. Doing incredible work.
I have no idea, so
Rudolf Schwarzkopf was known for wrapping this subject in gauze, totally and completely in gauze, head to foot. And then there's a classic photograph that I saw when I was a teenager this body, like a mummy, was stretched out on a cot, and there were tubes going from underneath this gauze, different areas of the body, like at the nose on the head and the navel, to jars that had different fluids in them. And the person who was inside the gauze was named Heinz Cibulka. Mm-hmm. Heinz Cibulka is now still very much around. He's an amazing guy, really amazing guy.
Heinz.
Yeah.
So these were some names, né? Do you have some other names which you would point out? We should look into.
Ooh.
Who is your uncle, for instance? Alan Kaprow.
Alan Kaprow was trying to do something with his work that I still don't really get. I don't really understand. He was looking to find this sort of I think the best way to describe it is this moment where you're sitting on a train. There are two trains in a train station. The trains are stopped. And then one of them starts to move, and you're not sure if it's the one you're on or the one that you're looking at through the window.
Uh-huh.
That kind of moment was something that he was looking into in his work, as I understand it.
That's nice.
Yeah, this.
I know this
experience.
Yeah. I know this also, and it's a good.
Yeah.
And you have to check for the firm grounds around.
Okay. Yeah, well, there is no firm ground. You're not really
check
sure
as much as you want.
And that was the thing that made. That was the thing that he was looking for. This moment where there is no. You don't know what's going on, and it doesn't really matter. It's just there. That's the impression that I got from his work. Somebody else who knows it better than I do could tell me I'm full of shit, and they're welcome to do so. I don't care. Yeah, but that's what I got.
And so what is important for you in sound? How do you approach it? What is sound for you?
It's changed a lot. At first, it was about creating a kind of assault.
Assault.
Huh? Attack. Yeah. A kind of attack. Sustained attack. Now it's more like creating a kind of seduction. What has value for me is a kind of a kind of internal search, and the music that I'm making now is a way of trying to sort of at the very least encourage that kind of internal search for the moment that it lasts, for the time that the music lasts.
So it makes you travel in your mind,
maybe,
or think, or
yeah,
but you also,
I mean, that's what it does for me, and that's what I'm sort of looking for.
And all these interfering sounds which arise because of the space in which they're mm-hmm. projected, and this is the massage that you get to.
Yeah, and it's different for every place that I perform it, because the acoustics and the space are always different. So it's always for me, it's always like, even though the elements I know, it's like hearing them. For it's hearing them differently, not for the first time, but differently. Yeah. So it's for me, it's a very sensual experience, and it's always like a sensual experience. It's always new.
Sensual.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you also want to encourage the listeners to come to this possible situation.
I put it out and see what happens.
Yes.
Whether or not that or whatever happens is up to it. That's more in control of the listener.
Mm.
That's what the listener brings to this. It's not just putting on a show and people just sort of sit and watch the show. It doesn't work like that. And it's a more of an interactive kind of process, or someone who's listening is not being in any way passive. It's more an active.
It doesn't work as consuming. It's needed as a relation.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
And the visual parts that you do, the movies, the film, no. Do you also find it sensual in that sense, or more
Well,
brain.
Those are more, for me, those are more sort of existential searches.
So, more linked to the words. And story.
An example.
Yeah.
I did a film called Another Useless Prayer, where the image that you see is this tunnel with these curved sides, and there is light that changes very, very slowly, very subtly. But you know that you're looking into a tunnel, and you start to sort of all kinds of things you can imagine. You start to think about where it goes. You start looking at the light and seeing the light as beautiful. Yeah, this the movement of the light can be very sublime. And after a while, you realize that you're looking into a toilet. So, the idea for me, when the inspiration for this was seeing something sublime at a moment where I least expected it. I like that.
When you were and making this,
yeah, when I was realizing when I was yeah when I was taking a piss, it. I was yeah. looking at the toilet. Yeah. And look, wait a minute, look at the light here. Look at that. That's nice. That's beautiful. Yeah. And that I did not. It was coming at a time where I was. I would often look at the toilet and I would think. I want to go down. I want to just. I've had enough. I just want to
flush
myself down and be done with all of this. Why did I get up today? Why am I still breathing? And I'm just feeling this, pissing into this toilet, and all of a sudden, I start seeing this beauty.
The light at the end of
this
the
tunnel. This elegance here, and I just okay. So that's what I mean. That they're sort of existential investigations.
Yeah. And for the public, then you present the beauty to catch them into.
You can
magic
see it as yeah. You can see
realization.
Yeah, you can see it as beautiful, you can see it as insulting, you can see it as repulsive, you can see it as however you want to, and that is what you bring to the film. It's not coming from the film, it's coming from you.
Mm-hmm. Nevertheless, in spite of all these holes, you still work, the whole life you work very actively, as I could follow. Moving through
like
different spaces.
So. Yeah.
I could observe this. You moved here close to Slovenia at one point.
Freely.
And as I remember, you were a lot of times at this Topolo station, Stazione Topolo.
Yeah.
Stazione Topolo
is
a small village which was empty of inhabitants, and somebody decided to make it as a kind of residency during the summer for the artists. Wasn't it like this?
The thing that interested me about this place was that, when I first moved to this village in Friuli, the year before I moved there, they suspended this law that made it illegal to take photographs in that area of anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they were afraid. It was the front line of the old Cold War, so they were desperately afraid that the East was going to come and invade this area, and finally, the year before I got there, they tried to start relaxing that a little bit. For example, there was a guy, a neighbor, who started a school where he offered to teach courses, elementary school courses, in Italian and Slovenian. His house was burned down.
Really?
By the neighbors who were hostile to Slovenian being taught to their children.
But this neighbor, he was a native of that village, or somebody?
His family had come from this area generations.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another example, Topolo was interesting because it was a village of 25 people, really cut off during the winter because the roads were impassable. So they were reliant, these 25 people, inhabitants, were reliant on news from the outside world coming from the Carabinieri, because the Carabinieri had the vehicles that could go up these roads and bring them the mail, bring them information about what was going on. And the Carabinieri told these people, this was pre Wi-Fi, they couldn't receive television, they couldn't get the signal. So they were completely reliant on news from the Carabinieri, and the Carabinieri told them that Slovenia and Yugoslavia was preparing an invasion of Italy, and that it was very important that every one of these people watch their neighbors for any signs of a positive attitude or positive comments made about Slovenia, that they should be reported immediately. So this group of 25 people, these inhabitants, were spying on each other. Can you imagine the living
little
like
DDR.
This in this tiny little village?
Well, this was in the West.
Yeah.
These people, they ended up so paranoid that it was a fascinating environment to see.
Like a new version of Satan Tango.
Exactly. Yeah. It was very much. It was very. Bellatar would have loved this. He should. Well, he stopped making films, but he
that
could
would
well
be
have
film.
Made a film about that. Yeah. Somebody should make a film about that.
Yeah, for instance, you.
That would be
but
fun,
you
wouldn't
you
it?
Were talking to these people,
yeah,
the inhabitants,
yeah, yeah,
remained,
yeah. So yeah, for and me it was interesting to go up there and to work up there.
Where is this situated? I mean, which
it's right at the border with
Tirol or
it's Slovenia part.
Yeah, it's right at the border.
I think it's where Tolmin is. Above to on
Kobarid,
the Italian side,
no?
Yeah. Something like that.
But so
Kobarid,
it's in Italy.
Yeah.
Kobarid.
Kobarid is city was, in Slovenia.
Yes, but that was the closest city to. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
area.
Around my new home.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, in Topolo, it was possible to take like a 45-minute walk and cross the border into Slovenia.
Mm-hmm.
So it was right there. It was. It's up in the mountains.
It was.
I was at this war line from First World War, which is some close to Kubarit. You go up, so it must be somewhere there close. It's really like lost hills, okay. And then a lot of war line from First and Second. But there's all this fest. How you say this?
Bush or
no? They made into the hills. They were making tunnels and
right.
all this stuff and had their materials there and shooting and dying.
Yeah.
Weird area. Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, in First World War, it was comparable to Verdun in amounts of people dying there.
Mm-hmm.
It was the other big. Slaughter field of the First World War. It's crazy. In the garden of that house there where we are often for years and years, at least the mother of my partner, she still found like
pieces
from like ammunition and from First World War.
Yeah.
Even there was also a lot in the second in that area, but this is all first.
Yeah.
So you have been more often in that residency there?
Yeah. My second wife, whose name was Giuliana Stefani, had relatives who ran a bar, like a trattoria, a restaurant and bar in a place right up in that same area. There's a sort of circle, a road that goes around in a circle. And this was up, their place was up on, up in that area.
And what did you do there then? How you stayed in this, what is it? Is it empty? Are there other artists? I have no idea how this functions.
Well, it's been quite a while since I was there.
No, but so when you were there,
I am elderly after all. When I was there, there were families still living there,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the first time that I played there, there was a man who complained, and his complaint was very interesting and. I played outside, and I tend to play loud. And he, I played, and fortunately, he didn't say anything while I played. But after I stopped, he came and said that it scared him to death because he had moved to this village to get away from airplane noise. Because he had worked in a job at an airport and had experiences with planes that scared him to death. So he wanted to be as far away from the sound of a jet engine as he could get. And then here I come and
give him the jet engine.
Yeah, he thought it was a jet engine all over again, and he stayed inside his house, locked and sort of protected until it was over.
But who else would watch there, this kind of, or listen? I mean, who comes there? People come up, or it's
People would come. People would drive up there.
From the city.
Yeah.
From Udine.
Yeah, from Udine, from Cividale, from more or less from that area. It was very much performing for the same people all the time.
That's like in Ljubljana.
Be more popular with what you do and you will get new people. Maybe.
Okay. I'll keep that in mind.
Some other questions. You were in Ljubljana, did we say, in 2007-8?
Yeah, something like that. I can't remember exactly when it was.
Boštjan, you were at his performance.
Were you?
But I don't remember when. In the castle. In the castle.
Up.
In the castle?
Castle, yeah.
Wasn't he at Kapelica Gallery?
No, but you...
No.
I played in the castle.
Yeah, because there was a lot of performance in the two floors, and all have some more sexual and pornographic.
This was a break 2.2. Or not?
No, it's not break. Yuri has there some this.
What I remember
of this.
Okay, what I remember was working in a chapel.
Yeah, this is Kapelica. Yes.
And I projected images of vaginas onto the wall of this.
Oh, yeah. But it was a
real far wall of this chapel, and had a guard dog at the entrance.
A dog.
The guard dog was supposed to protect this chapel with this icon image projected, or this vagina image projected. In the place where the cross would normally be.
Blasphemy.
But was it like, was it a chapel in some old building, or was it a chapel in some house? Because Kapelica itself, the gallery, means chapel, and it's an old chapel, but it's not like looking old. It's like a gallery space, which has still this little round end.
Yeah, that's it. That's the place.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so it was in Kapelica.
Yeah. That was it. Yeah.
And you thought to come in, and then you thought, I'm in the chapel.
Yeah, well, the idea was that the dog would prevent anyone coming into this chapel. The dog would, like the attack dog, would be there barking at anyone who tried to come in. Yeah.
And did people come in?
Well, yeah, it was a big misunderstanding with Yuri Kurpan. I told him that I wanted an attack dog, and he talked to somebody who took care of guard dogs, who provided guard dogs. But the guy who provided the dog was more interested in protecting the dog. So he made sure the dog understood that these people who were coming into this place were not harmful. So people just walked past the dog and maybe petted the dog.
That was some kind of misunderstanding.
Yeah.
No, as a gallerist, you want that people enter the gallery often. They want it.
Yeah, well, it's... Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, what about pornography?
What about it?
Do you see it as good? Somewhere I read that you were...
I see it as a mirror.
As a mirror.
As a kind of social mirror. That it reflects the things that people try to hide from themselves.
Or dream but hide from others. Or
also. Yeah. Yeah. So,
is it useful?
To a point.
For these reasons, yeah.
To a point. I still like it.
But you were making some.
Especially now,
movies.
Especially in my elder years, I like. Yeah, I like pornography. But I used to make pornography. I used to in Japan. I had a job as a director.
You got a job, or you had to create it?
No, I got a job.
Uh-huh, it was not independent
directing.
Production, but.
No. It was for a production house. Yeah, it was a very interesting job. It was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. And it attracted people who were very unusual. For one thing, the production itself is not involved with the mafia, so it it attracts people who can get in and get right back out again. A lot of the people who come and make one or two films do so in order to get money to do the things that they really want to do. For example, there was one of my favorite actors was a woman who was a race car driver. And she did these films to get the money to pay the track fees, pay her mechanic, pay for the car, pay for maintenance on the car, and you know, all of these things. So to fund the life that she took seriously. Yeah. There was a guy, another favorite actor who was in his 50s at that time. He was known as a comic book artist, as a manga artist, but he did this as a way to pay his bills. But what made him interesting for me was that he could not get an erection unless he was watching uncensored pornography on a TV screen.
On a TV screen?
Yeah.
Not live, but...
Live didn't work. With one exception, in the film where we worked, he was working with an actress, and he was working with another actor, and got an erection from her, and that was
love.
That unusual, extremely unusual. Yeah, but I saw him as a real example of some like 20th century male, somebody who cannot actually respond to people unless there is this filter where he's watching them, not where there is where the possibility of actual contact, touch, is
eliminated
yeah. entirely. Yeah. That I thought was really, really interesting, and I thought, yeah, this is very modern kind of human being. So I liked him very much. And then there was a woman who had this. She was just the opposite. She could get a rapport with the camera.
Yeah.
Where, if you're watching, it's like she's talking directly to you. It was uncanny. This ability that she had is absolutely stunning. Yeah. She was great to work with, too. But all of these people were really sort of outside of normal Japanese society. But also, they didn't have pornography in Japan did not have this kind of stigma that it has here.
You mean at that time, already in Europe or in US, it had stigma? I think it was kind of progression.
I tried to bring this up at a party a couple of months ago, where we were all, it was a dinner party, we were all talking about what we were doing, and it came up that I had directed these movies, and I talked about how much I liked it, and it just silenced these people. Turns out there was one guy there who had worked in erotic films, but he tried to hide it. He tried to sort of keep it hidden. And everybody else just kind of went, well, oh, gee, it's getting late, isn't it? We should go. Yeah, they were trying to find some excuse to sort of leave. as soon as this came up, and I thought, you know, this is interesting. But in Japan, it's not like that. It doesn't. People don't have that kind of.
It's still not like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You think it's because of lack of Catholicism or Christian?
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. They don't have this two-fanged poison of sin and guilt.
Yeah, I think that we somehow fulfilled what we are here. Huh?
That we put it together.
Yeah, we can still finish it in some way or also not. Huh?
Finish.
This conversation.
This conversation?
Yeah.
Okay.
Will we make an end or just let it fly?
Do we fade out or do we make an end? Normally I hate fade out. Where you just... Yeah.
Would you like to try singing again?
For instance, this could be the end. I was just thinking about that.
Yes. Just put the T.
Go as chorus, okay. Go a bit back and you go a bit forward.
Just give me a second.
And you want to do this?
Yeah.
Let's okay.
Let them stop.
Yeah. Lay down. Lay down.
Lay down.